Good evening, Bedford.
Good evening.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight from Bedford, from surrounding communities. It's an honor to be here. It's an honor to represent you. And I look forward to our discussion. So I'm going to give a relatively brief introduction to talk about some of the issues of the day and the priorities of my team and my office. But then I want to hear from you. And I would ask that you think about questions you would like to address. We will have members of my team going around with microphones. They will do the job of picking who gets to ask questions so I don't get in trouble when I don't call on the right person. But I'm eager to hear. Make sure you ask questions that end in a question mark, and I look forward to them. But let me begin on a rather somber note, frightening note, with the elephant in the room in America today, which is what's going on in Charlottesville, Virginia, and inspired by that in other parts of the country. We're talking about Nazi rallies, not in Germany in 1936 or 1939, but in the United States of America in the summer of 2017.
Thank you.
And that is a frightening, frightening thing for all of us to witness, to experience. The terror, this is a domestic terror attack, what happened down in Charlottesville, Virginia. The hatred, the racism, the outright racism and anti-Semitism that we see on the streets of America today is something that, frankly, we thought we had moved past. It is completely against our values, against our Constitution, against our laws. When you're inciting hatred and you're killing people at your rallies, that is not free speech. And I think it should serve as a reminder to all of us that we still have that we still have a lot of work to do. America has, still got this? Sound, gentlemen? Here we go. America has a truly revolutionary set of values. In fact, some of the revolutionaries who helped establish those values for our country come from our district, from this town, from my hometown. True patriots who stood up in a time of challenge and didn't take a position of neutrality, didn't try to appease their base. They stood up for what's right. They stood up for everybody, for true liberty, freedom, and equality. And it's a time, again, in America where when we need those same kinds of patriots. Not sunshine patriots, but people who are going to stand up for our values in times of challenge, in times of testing. Right here in Massachusetts, if you look closely enough, and it doesn't take that much effort, you can see that we are still a segregated community. Not by law, not by practice, not certainly by our Massachusetts values. And yet that's still the case. I see it in my own district. Towns, cities that are majority-minority, and right next door, towns that look completely different. The painful reality of our district, of our Commonwealth, and indeed the United States of America, is it does matter what color your skin is. It does matter what zip code you're born in. That we are not truly a nation of equality. We haven't yet lived up to that ideal of equal opportunity for all. And by the way, we've never said we're a country of equal results, that everybody's going to end up the same. But we've always said that we are a country of equal opportunity. That it shouldn't matter who your parents are, or how much money they have, or what the color of your skin is, or your sexual orientation is, or the zip code in which you were born, everybody in America has the opportunity to do great things, to succeed, to truly realize the American dream. So we have work to do. And we can't just look at Charlottesville and say, well, that's the South, that's Virginia. We've got to look ourselves in the mirror right here in this community and think about what we can do here at home to start to change this, to be the example of leadership that Massachusetts has been on so many other issues, on healthcare, on marriage equality. This is a time when we need patriots again, and we need them right here at home. So let me move on now to some of the other issues that we're dealing with in my office and in the country today. A lot of people ask, you know, Seth, what are your priorities? How do you think about what to focus on with all these things swirling around, all these challenges facing our country today? Well, I used to talk about this just in terms of district priorities, national priorities, and then international priorities. And we still have those ways of organizing things. But since the election, I have sort of different lists. And it starts with simply being willing to stand up to the president, to the White House, when he's doing things that assault our values, our Constitution, who we are as Americans. Now, I'm willing to work with the president if he starts doing something positive and productive. You know, if the president wants to actually fulfill his campaign promise to bring good jobs to American citizens, if he wants to fulfill his campaign progress to work on infrastructure, you all know infrastructure is really important to me, then I'll work with him just like I work across the aisle with so many other Republicans. In fact, I was recently named the most bipartisan member of Congress in Massachusetts, just in terms of my ability to work across the aisle. I'm proud of that. I'm proud of that because that's how we get things done. That's how you've got to get things done in America. That's what the Founding Fathers intended. Not crafting healthcare bills or tax cuts, whatever you want to call it, behind closed doors without a single hearing, without ever involving anyone from the opposite party, but working together on the values that we share. Now, the second thing I'm doing, the second priority that we have, is I'm trying to reform my own party. Because Democrats in America have got to be able to look ourselves in the mirror and say, you know what, we've lost. We've lost a lot of elections. In fact, we're in the worst electoral position that we've been in decades. And I don't care what party label you ascribe to, I think that's bad for our country. Because it means we don't have balance in Washington. It means when a president wants to take away health care from 23 million Americans, there's no opposition to the party to say, well, you're not going to do that, because that's not good for America. But if Democrats want to start winning again, we've got to take a serious look at what we need to do differently. I'm sure many of you have small businesses. I stopped by, but it was closed. Thank you. And if you were losing money hand over fist, year after year, you wouldn't come to your annual meeting with your employees and say, you know what, everybody, we're going to do everything exactly the same. We're not going to change anything. That's crazy. So Democrats have got to be willing to change. We've got to get some new leadership in the Democratic Party. In fact, I think it's time for a new generation of leadership in the Democratic Party. That's why one of the things I've been doing is going around the country and trying to recruit good Americans to run for office. Americans who won't run on a party label, but will run on doing the right thing for the country. You know, people like Mikey Sherrill down in New Jersey. People aren't going to vote for Mikey because she's a Democrat. They're going to vote for her because she's a leader, because she flew helicopters in the Navy. She knows how to lead. She will inspire people because she's a great American, not just because she's a great Democrat. So that's one of the things that I'm working on, that my team is working on. And if we're going to do that, I think Democrats, Republicans, I think everybody in America has to come to terms with some of the things that are causing this unrest, that are leading people to feel uncertain about their futures. This is the first time that a generation of Americans looks at their kids and says, "You may not do as well as we have." That's never happened in America before. For all our challenges, our troubles, we've always been able to say, "My kids will be better off than I was." But we can't say that today. And so I think we've got to come to terms with what's really happening in America to our economy. Because you know what? People are standing on factory floors today, not really worried that their job is going to be taken by an immigrant, like the president says. No, they're worried that their job is going to be taken by a robot, automated out of existence, and the two guys next to them will lose their jobs too. I mean, we have lawyers losing their jobs to automation. You know, you don't need to go to a lawyer to get a will anymore, because you can do it at a website online. It just figures out what you need based on your input. Now, this technological advancement has opened up tremendous opportunities. I don't think we want to give up all of our phones. Well, there may be some parents who want their kids to give up their phones, but I think most of us don't want to give up all the advancements that we've made, but they have consequences and we've got to face them squarely. And we've got to say, how is it that everybody in America can be a part of the new economy? Because we need you. We want you. It's not enough just for the coasts to be doing well. We have Amazon Robotics based here in the district. They're hiring. But when they make those robots, they take jobs. So the automated economy looks great if you're working at Amazon Robotics right now. But if you're shifting boxes in the warehouse, you're kind of wondering, when is one of those robots going to come and replace me? So rather than go around and say, "Well, you know what we need to do, guys, is we need to go down and get some pickaxes and go back into the coal mines. That's going to solve our problems." Come on. Even the coal miners don't believe that. And it's not just environmental regulations. Hey, look, I'm a Democrat who's willing to say there are some government regulations that are out of control. But there are also there are a lot of regulations that literally save lives every day, because they mean that we can trust the water that we drink and the air that we breathe. So just wholesale getting rid of regulations, that's not going to fix the problem either. It'll create more problems than it will fix. So we've got to be honest about what's facing our economy and figure out, how do we actually address this? What are real ways that we can meet the challenges of this rapidly changing economy? Like how do we make sure that if you lose your job when you're 50, you have the opportunity to train for a new job? Because we want your help. You know, what does it mean for education? How do we better educate our kids to be prepared for the jobs that are going to come 20 years from now, not just the jobs that exist today? What does it mean for healthcare? A lot of people switch jobs so quickly because jobs are changing so rapidly. But if you always have to just rely on your employer for healthcare, it's pretty hard to leave your job, even if there's a better opportunity down the street. But these are the real questions that we have to address here at home and in Washington, and I think that's an opportunity for us. So that's another thing that we're working on. Look, there are challenges that we see every single day across the world, Syria, North Korea. I'd be happy to take questions on those. There are challenges that we see right here at home. Veterans health care. As you know, I made a commitment when I got elected to get my own health care at the VA, to continue getting it there, not to get it through Congress. I go to the VA down the street. It's one of the best VA hospitals in the country, but it could be better. And we're working on that, because I think veterans deserve the best health care in the world, period. And then there are challenges that we all face just right here at home. You know, and the number of times a day that the men and women in my office pick up the phone and help people like you get the Social Security check that you deserve. You know, get the veterans' benefits that you have earned. It's extraordinary. We have literally returned hundreds of thousands of dollars to the people of the 6th District of Massachusetts just in the 2.5 years that I've been in office. And that's some of the most important work that we do every single day. So with that introduction, I would be delighted to take your questions. And I want to thank you again for coming out on a summer evening to have this conversation with me. Fundamental to my job, is listening to your concerns. I can't do my job as your representative in Washington if I don't understand what's on your minds. So you're helping my team and me do our jobs tonight. And for that, I'm grateful. Thanks. Okay. Lucas from Lowell is our master of ceremonies here on this side of the aisle.
Good evening to all. I'm Karen Rose from Billerica.
Karen, thank you. And by the way, when you have a question, just like Karen did, if you can introduce yourself, tell me your name and where you're from, that's great. So thank you, and thank you for coming over from Billerica.
What, in your opinion, does the DNC need to do to get more votes, to get a message out there that unites voters so that we can't take back the Congress and the White House?
Sure. So this is a sort of a political question about the DNC, and I don't want to get too much into politics tonight. I want to focus on policy. But it's a fair question, and it's a question that certainly Democrats have got to be asking right now. And I think the DNC, like other parts of our party, you know, really need to say, what can we do differently to start winning again? I think we need a new message. Now, how many of you have heard the new Democratic message? It's called a better deal. Hey, look, it's a step in the right direction, all right? It's a step in the right direction. But I think it needs some more work. Maybe that reveals a lot about where I stand on all of this with the DNC. Look, I think a lot of the energy and the activism that's so, you know, that's everywhere in America today, largely in response to the election, in response to our president, you know, that's one of the best things to come out of this election, but it's not just through the party. You know, there are people who are standing up and saying, I want to make a difference. I've never been involved with politics before. But I wasn't involved with politics before I ran. Now, I got recruited by this nonprofit that's trying to get veterans to run, but I hadn't done anything before. And I think this is a time when more people like that are stepping up and saying, you know, I want to serve the country, or I want to make a difference, I want to help get the right people elected, whatever it is. But they're not necessarily, you know, part of this party structure. And I think that's a healthy thing for our democracy. All right, over here.
Hi, my name's Cassidy.
Hi, Cassie. I think maybe the mic's not on, so Anna is coming to the rescue.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, all right.
So I'm Cassidy, if you can hear me. I wanted to ask about gender discrimination.
Sure.
Your website says that if we are truly going to bring equality to the workplace, we need to look deeper than wage-based discrimination. In your term, what legislation do you plan to introduce or support to help this?
It's a great question. The question is about, for those of you who couldn't hear, gender discrimination in the workplace. And we hear a lot about these statistics that say, you know, women doing the same work are not getting paid as much as men. But my point with what I said on the website is it's not just that. It's not just numbers. You know, it's about who gets promoted. You know, if you're doing a good job, you shouldn't get promoted based on whether you're a male or female. You should get promoted based on the job that you do, the leader that you are. And so I have sponsored or co-sponsored a number of pieces of legislation that try to advance this, that say, you know, if you are a company in America, you can't discriminate based on gender. The Lilly Ledbetter Act is an example of this legislation that will go way beyond where we are today in terms of ensuring equality in the workplace? Because the reality is that it's not equal today. And there are a lot of statistics we could go through that show this. But if you think about it, we started this discussion tonight by talking about how we haven't reached that ideal yet. We haven't truly become a nation of equal opportunity. We still have work to do, and this is a great place where we still got to keep working. So thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is Paul Jameson. I'm from Concord, not in this district, just on the edge. But I would like to know why we continue subsidizing the illegal segregation and oppression of Palestinians that goes on in Israel. We keep sending large amounts of money to support illegal actions by the State of Israel.
Well, look, I appreciate the question. This is a controversial issue, and we can hear by just the quick response to your question that there are different views in the room. And look, Israel is our most important and steadfast ally in the Middle East, but that doesn't mean that we agree with everything they do. And in fact, I don't think there's an ally out there that we agree with everything they do. That's one of the tough parts of having allies, right? Wasn't it Churchill said that the only thing worse than having to deal with allies is not having them or something like that? I totally butchered that quote, but someone can help me. So I don't agree with all the ways that Israel treats Palestinians. But I do think on balance, it's important to have Israel as an ally. And there's far more that we agree with Israel on than where we disagree. And so that's why I support continued aid. But I also support continued pushing, saying to Israel when we disagree with them, when we think they should be doing things differently. And, you know, I traveled to Israel in the height of the debate over the Iran nuclear deal, because I wanted to hear from the Israeli Prime Minister, the number one chief critic of this deal, why he thought we shouldn't sign it, and most importantly, what the alternative was. So I went there, I listened to him, and frankly, I disagree with him. And I told him where I disagreed, I gave him an opportunity to respond. In this particular instance, I said, I can agree with you that it's not a perfect deal. You can probably all agree with that, but how are you going to get a better deal? So I pushed him on that. And when he didn't have a good answer, when he literally could not describe a pathway to a better deal, that's one of the reasons why I came out and supported the deal. But the point is that I'm willing to push the Israelis, and I think that's what we need to do as a government, but it doesn't mean that we should abandon them as an ally. Thank you. Okay, yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Abhishek. I live in Linfield, originally from India, and a legal immigrant in this country.
Well, we're happy to have you. Thank you.
I've been here 15 years. I just completed 15 years, in fact. Before I ask my question, I wanted to throw out an invite to hold your next town hall in Linfield. I know you may not like the politics of our town, but you love the people there.
Well, listen, it has nothing to do with politics. I was the single Democrat in the House and Senate last term to hold the most town halls in all Congress. I held one in every one of the 39 cities and towns that I represent, including Linfield. So don't worry, we'll be back. I don't know if it's on the calendar yet, but we will be back.
My question is about the RAISE bill that was recently introduced by two Republican senators about the legal immigration, which in a nutshell talks about reducing the number of legal immigrants in the country. And I think there are a lot of merits in that bill, but unfortunately Democrats have just said no without even going through specifics. You talked about working with, you know, the other side of the aisle. What is your position on that, and what do you think should be done to kind of promote that idea?
Sure. So this bill that's been proposed by Senator Cotton and some other conservative Republicans would dramatically change our immigration system, especially, you know, the legal immigration system, and would dramatically cut immigration to America. Now, I have a lot of concerns with this bill, some moral, some basic economic. I mean, economists will tell you that this is a bad bill for our economy. So there are some real concerns I have with this legislation, but what I will say is that we need to have this debate. And right now, the problem in the House of Representatives is that Speaker Ryan is not letting us even consider immigration reform bills. There is a bill that passed the Senate several years ago that really reforms our immigration system. It starts by strengthening our borders, by the way, to make sure that more people come here legally like you did, rather than illegally, but also provides a pathway to citizenship for those who are already a part of our communities and frankly want to contribute to our communities. It's one of the reasons why this piece of legislation actually dramatically reduces our deficit, because it puts undocumented workers on the tax rolls. So they're paying taxes like all the rest of us. The irony is that Speaker Ryan has personally said that he supports this bill, and yet because of the influence the Tea Party has over him, he won't let it come up for a debate. He won't let it come up for a vote. That's the kind of comprehensive immigration reform that we need to have in America. I don't think this particular bill meets those goals, but it has to be part of the debate, and it's a debate we ought to have. Thank you. Okay, yes, sir. Just, Lucas, make sure you're getting down here to see some of the folks in the front, too, who are raising their hands.
Brendan Murphy, Salem. I'm actually a first-time candidate to be your ward counselor, believe it or not.
Thank you very much for coming out from Salem. Thank you.
But my question isn't regarding that. So back in Salem, as you believe you know, because I think you mentioned it when you were back in town the other day, we have the Sanctuary for Peace ordinance that we passed. And I was wondering if you were willing to state your feelings on that.
Sure, absolutely. And in fact, I have stated them. I have had a public statement on this. I support what Salem, my town, is doing. Because I think that it is wrong for the president of the federal government to threaten to take away federal funds because we're welcoming the people who are a part of our community. And in fact, a recent court decision upheld that. So it seems that we are not just on the right side of history, but the right side of the law with this position. But it gets back to the reason that we need to have a serious debate about immigration reform in America. And it's not enough just to say that, you know, we're going to paper over the problems because the status quo is okay. We've got to address this. And it requires people on both sides of the aisle. This is one of those issues that it's not going to work very well if we have Republican immigration reform. Or frankly, if we have Democratic immigration reform. It's got to be bipartisan immigration reform. That's the way that we can make a change that will last in America today. So thank you. Wonderful. No. Is that working? No. Anna, just hold it for me.
Have I got it with help from my friends?
You got it. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Meredith McCulloch. I'm from Bedford. And I'm concerned about the regulations that are just disappearing unnoticed by the public or by the Congress. One is the regulation from the FCC limiting the number of television outlets that a corporation can hold. As you're probably aware, one corporation is trying to buy up all the TV stations in the country that it can, and will therefore have a lot of control over what our news is. The second one is the Consumer Protection Agency, which is fairly new, but I think is being effective, and I understand they're trying to dismantle that. There are others that I don't know about, but you probably do.
Well, thank you. Yes, and in fact, you know, one of the things I do differently from other members of Congress is I actually post explanations for all the votes that I take, all the bills we vote on my website. So we go through, you know, the pros and the cons and where I came out on a certain bill. And we've had a number of pieces of legislation that were passed by Republicans essentially to undo regulations like some of the ones you described that I've detailed on my website. So there are a number of issues like this, including the ones you've mentioned. But look, there's a lot of monopolization going on in America right now. And come back to our values, we're a land of equal opportunity, not of monopolies. And that's why some of these regulations exist. Now, look, I will tell you, the Republicans have a point that some government regulation is unnecessary and it's gone too far. And there are government regulations out there that have really outlived their intended purpose. And I have a friend who's a veteran and trying to start a business, and he was just going through all the red tape that he has to go through to simply become someone who can accept a government contractor. And then people wonder why the biggest corporations in America get government contracts and not small businesses. So there are government regulations that we should get rid of, but ones that protect us from monopolies, ones that protect us from corporations polluting our water and our air just to boost their profits, those are regulations that are helpful, that we should have in place. And so that's why I voted against so many of these issues when they've come up. We have a federal regulatory process. It isn't perfect. It could be better. I agree. But just simply having the attitude that any regulation is a bad regulation ignores reality. So thank you. Thanks for the question. Okay. Hi.
Ovich from Bedford, is that working?
It is now, thank you.
Thank you for being here, and thank you to your staff. I write you multiple times a week. I call your office multiple times a week. I've never been so upset in my entire life about what's going on, and I sincerely appreciate your office staff, as well as everything that you're doing on our behalf.
Thank you. Let me just say, I'm so proud of my team as well, and we try to respond to every single piece of correspondence that comes to us, by email, by phone, by people walking in the office. It's literally thousands of pieces of mail a week, but we try to respond to everyone. In fact, if you go to our website, we will even post the average response time, so you can know about when to expect something back from us. So thank you for saying that, and thank you for recognizing the hard work of my team.
To a comment that you made about Social Security.
Sure.
And it's my understanding, and I will stand corrected if my statistics are wrong, it's my understanding that those who are on Social Security now in the year 2030 will be required to take a 30% pay cut unless something is done by Congress about the funding and the sustenance in Social Security program as it stands right now. And I would like to know what, if anything, Congress intends to do about it in the morass of stuff that you've already got to deal with.
Well, I don't want to be pessimistic, but what Congress intends to do right now is nothing, because there are not enough people in Congress who are willing to face this issue, because it's politically contentious. But I'll tell you, when I first ran, I was speaking to a group, I think it was out in Lynn, and they were quite angry with me, and they said, Seth, we heard that you're open to changes in Social Security. Social Security is going to be good for the next 25 years. Why would you want to change it? And I said, guys, I'm 35. 25 years don't work so well for me. We've got to make sure that these programs that are so essential, you know, like to my parents who are retiring now, that they exist not just for my parents, but for my brother and sister and I, and for our kids someday, for your kids. So that's why we got to be willing to have this debate in Washington. It's one of the reasons why I've signed on to a Social Security reform bill. In fact, I brought the author of that bill, Representative John Larson from Connecticut, up to speak in Danvers to a wonderful group of senior citizens, you know, who would be affected by this, to talk about why we need to make some changes. You know, one of the things we could do to Social Security is we could just remove the cap. The cap is what prevents people who make a lot of money from contributing more. And you know what? We did that for Medicare back in 1996. It shouldn't be that hard to do for Social Security as well. And if we just did that, it would take care of 80% of the problem. But I'm not an 80% kind of guy. I think we need to take care of 100% of the problem. Absolutely. So I agree with you, and I appreciate the question. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Good evening. My name is Jeffrey Everson. I'm from Reading, and you brought up the subject of health care. Here's a fact that never seems to get aired. Turns out that several years ago, Elizabeth Warren, when she worked at Harvard Law School, combined forces with two MDs from Harvard Medical School. They examined about 2,000 bankruptcy cases, and they discovered after a lot of analysis that 62% of those bankruptcy cases were due to unpaid medical bills. 62%. And nowadays that translates out to about 600,000 people that are struck by medical bankruptcy every year. 600,000, that's a huge number. It almost never happens in other countries because they have governments that put caps on medical expenses. So what can you do in Congress to help us take care of some of us instead of, you know, the medical community? Thank you.
Well, there's a lot we can do, and thank you for the question. I have never said that Obamacare is perfect, all right? I have never said that the Affordable Care Act can't be improved. You do know those are the same thing, by the way, the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare, because a lot of Americans don't. And it's okay if you didn't, but they are the same thing, all right? The Affordable Care Act has way higher popularity ratings than Obamacare. But look, it's not perfect. And frankly, this is a place where Massachusetts has led, because we didn't just pass a perfect healthcare law in 2006. We passed a healthcare law that was revolutionary, but then we amended it, and we changed it, and we made it better year after year. So that eventually became way more popular than even Obamacare. That's the kind of example that we should follow in Washington. And by the way, that law was passed by a Republican governor with a Democratic legislature. It was bipartisan from the beginning. That's part of the reason I think it was so popular. So there's a lot of work that we need to do to fix this problem. But let me just, rather than just talk about policy for a second, let me just talk to you about how this makes me feel. You know, I served in the war with some of the best Americans I've ever met in my life. Some of them are rich, but a lot of them are poor. And when I look at those guys, like the one who sent a Facebook message to our platoon group last night and said he needs help and he needs to know from the rest of us how to apply for help with the VA. When I look at them and what they've sacrificed for this country, I don't say, you know, you've done a lot for America, but Donald Trump's kids, they deserve better health care because they're rich. And yet that's the system we have right now. That's the healthcare system we have in America, where if you're rich, you get better healthcare. And I don't think that's right. I think healthcare is a right, not a privilege.
Seth, we have time for one more question, but we're going to give do three quick questions and then have you answer all three of them at once. So.
I don't know how they convinced you to take that deal, Lucas, but all right, that's fine. Listen, we are ending a little bit early because we're going to go across the street to the vigil for Charlottesville, and it starts at 8, so I want to make sure that everybody who wants to come can get there on time. Okay, yes, sir.
All right, my name is Liam O'Toole. I'm actually a student here at BHS.
Great.
And while we're on the topic of healthcare, and you just said healthcare is a right, not a privilege, right? So I want to know, 62% of Americans now support Medicare for All, and so 85% of Democrats and left-leaning independents, and 116 Democrats in the House right now co-sponsored John Conyers' Medicare for All bill, which is HR 676.
Right.
I want to know why you haven't yet.
Sure, it's a great question. I'd be happy to answer it. Over here.
So you talk a lot about jobs, but I don't hear a lot from the Democratic Party talking about raising the federal minimum wage. I mean, there's the fight for 15, which is great, but I mean, the federal minimum wage is like, what, $3.75? not enough. It's not enough. And the other thing is the gig economy. And, you know, we touched on Social Security, like the gig economy, the Ubers, the Lyft, the Postmates, everyone that, you know, hires independent contractors, they're not paying payroll taxes, which is 70% of your taxes, and they're not also paying into Social Security, so that's a good way of, I don't know, funding Social Security for all of us, especially us who are in our 30s.
Okay, sorry, what's your name?
Oh, I'm Kayla from Bedford. Yeah, I should have started with that.
Great, thank you. Thanks, Kayla. All right, one more. Okay, over here. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Congressman. My name's Mark Cowan. I'm a captain in the Marine Corps Reserve.
Well, thank you very much. Semper Fi.
Not a policy question, but my question for you, sir, is as a fellow veteran serving in Congress, you know, a lot of my Marines and my team are very impressed by your accomplishments in the government. What I want to know from you is what can we still serving in the military do to be more involved in today's government?
That's a great question. Thank you. Thank you for asking that question. So let me start with the Medicare for All question. I think that everybody should have the option for single-payer health care. And the only reason I haven't signed on to this one particular bill is because, frankly, it's just not a very good bill. And if you actually read the bill and see how it's all going to be paid for, it's a mess. And I think it's responsible not just to sign on to legislation because it's a great political talking point, but because it'll actually make things better. That's why I'm willing to have this tough debate about Social Security. Because, you know, it's really politically popular just to say, oh, I'm not going to change Social Security. But then you get into the details and you realize Social Security isn't going to be there for people like you and me. So I absolutely support the idea that everybody in America should have the option, although not the requirement, for single-payer health care. I just don't think John Conyers' bill gets us where we need to go. The next question over here was about the gig economy and, you know, all these people who were out there working for Uber and whatnot and not getting the protections that we've come to expect. In a lot of cases, it seems like companies are just trying to wiggle around the rules. And these are some of the changes that we need to make. These are some of the regulations that would actually make our economy better, that would help people get protection. Because you know what? If someone works for a company, you know, 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, but doesn't have health care because the company's wiggled out of the rules for getting health care, what happens when that employee gets sick? Well, he goes to the emergency room. And if she goes to the emergency room, guess who's paying her health care? Not that company, all of us. So those are some of the things that we need to change. This is why we've got to bring government into the 21st century. We've got to have a government regulatory framework that responds to the challenges of today and doesn't just have a bunch of outdated regulations that don't really work for the new economy. So I appreciate you bringing that up. And by the way, that's why we need young people involved in this too, because young people understand the gig economy, and not all of my colleagues do. Sir, first of all, thank you for your service. I'm proud that you're still serving. And you've asked a great question. You know, I'll tell you what, when I was in the Marines, I didn't have any plans to go into politics. In fact, when I got out, I went to business school, and then like every aspiring Massachusetts politician, I took a job in Dallas, Texas. Okay, so that's not what you do if you want to run for office in Massachusetts. But nonetheless, I was quoted, I don't remember where, at some point back in 2004 when I disagreed with the war and disagreed with our commander-in-chief at the time. I said, our commander-in-chief, who was President Bush, you know, he can tell us to do all sorts of things as a commander-in-chief, and I, as a Marine officer, will follow his orders. But there's one thing he can't tell us, and that is how to vote. And there is this debate that goes on in the military about whether or not the military, people who are service members, should be involved in politics. Now, of course, there are very important rules that form important barriers around what you can and can't do. And those rules are very well intentioned. They're within our Constitution. They make sure that we have a fundamentally nonpartisan military. But you've got to get out and vote. And you got to make sure that people like your friends and family know how you feel. Because you know what? when our commander-in-chief makes decisions in Washington, like sending troops back into Iraq, sending troops into Syria without a clue about why they're there, with using a whole bunch of bluster, which I think is mostly a blunder, against North Korea, threatening all sorts of things that our military commanders know are not going to work, you know who pays the price? To a certain extent, we all do, but you pay it first. And so my advice to you is not a whole bunch of specifics, but it's when you hear your fellow Marines say, I don't want to vote, I don't think I should have an opinion, you say, you ought to care, because this affects you more than just about anybody else in America. So thank you. Thanks for coming. Thanks for being engaged. And thank you all for being willing to take part in this conversation. This is so important. And let me say one more thing. Going to Washington right now isn't always a lot of fun. All right? You know, I'm sure some of you have tougher jobs than I do, but this isn't the best, most inspiring time to be a member of Congress. But I'll tell you what is inspiring. It's coming back to people like you, to crowds like this, to seeing people who truly care about our country, who want to make it better, who, by the way, don't agree on every issue. We're not going to agree. I mean, I take hundreds of votes down in D.C. You're not going to agree with every single vote. But I want you to know that I am so proud to represent you. I'm so proud of this district. I'm proud of this town. I'm proud to be your representative in Washington. Fundamentally, I am a public servant. In fact, I took the exact same oath as a member of Congress that I took as a United States Marine officer. That's an oath I take more seriously than anything else in the world. It means that I work for you, not the other way around. I will never forget that. I'm proud to represent you, and I thank you so much for coming out tonight.